Mr. Sally, real one. Where were you born, please?
Exeter.
In which year?
1920.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a time-serving Royal Naval man. He was a master at arms.
Did you have your education in Exeter?
Yes, I did. I won a scholarship to Heald School.
How old were you when you left school?
17.
So that was in 1937?
That's right.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I got a job with Devon County Council.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I was with the Devon County Council on the administrative side of the education department.
What was your reaction to the news that we were at war?
A mixture of panic and elation and wondering what I was going to do.
Did you join the forces straight away?
No. Well, my father was at sea at that time. He was in an armed merchant cruiser, HMS Carthage. And I didn't volunteer at that time. And another complication was that shortly after the fall of France, I think it was before the fall of France, the village constable, I lived in a little village called Alfington, which is a suburb of Exeter now, came to my mother and said, "Would you mind if I took your boy away for some special training, but you mustn't ask him what it was?" And this turned out to be what is now called the last ditch. I don't know if you know what the last ditch was. And I was one of the chaps who he said would be regarded as unfit for service, although I was as fit as a fiddle. And I would be left behind country and act as a saboteur like the Marquis in France, one assumes. And I did a certain amount of training on that. I had to blow up a railway line, all in secret, of course. But after a while, you know, it was quite obvious that the Germans weren't going to come across. And I said, "Look, I want to be released from this," which they did. And I volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm.
Can you tell me a bit more about the training you had to be a saboteur?
Well, it's all a little bit vague at the moment. But I do remember going down to Dawlish into a field there, where they had all sorts of plastic explosives and that sort of thing. I particularly remember the device they had for setting fire to lorries and things like that. And that was a rubber container which contained, I believe, petrol. And on the end of it, it had a coating which looked like a normal safety match. And all you had to do to set the thing off was to rub it on a matchbox and throw it, and that would start things off. And there were also time delay fuses and that sort of thing for blowing up railway lines.
Would you have been in uniform?
Oh, no. We were, as I say, a resistance outfit, and we were lying low. Allegedly, I was unfit for service, and that was why I wasn't in the services. And we would have been behind the lines. The Germans would have overrun the place, and we would be generally interfering and messing them about.
So what would have happened to you if the Germans had caught you?
Oh, shot, I should think, immediately.
How many of you were doing this training?
There were four of us in the little village of Alfington that I know of, and we came under the jurisdiction, if that's the right word, of a chap called Professor Arnold Riley, and he was a professor of something or other at the University of Exeter. Or University College of Exeter, as it was in those days.
Did you meet him?
Yes.
Did he seem grim about the whole thing?
Grim? No, I think he took it as more as a matter of fact. You know, here's a job to do, let's get on with it.
Did you know the other three?
Yes, very well, yes. One was the son of the village postmaster, Stanley Budd. One was a farmer called Mervyn Ash. And the other was a chap called Donald Skeynes, who kept an electricity shop in Alfington. There were four of us.
Did they all seem keen to do it?
Well, they volunteered, so they must have been, yes.
Do you think you would have done a good job?
Well, we'd have done as well as we could have done. Whether it would have been good in the eyes of real professional SAS men, I rather doubt, but at least it would have been a needle in the side of the Germans, wouldn't it?
Where would you have operated?
Well, in our village, I imagine.
When were you released from that?
It's hard to tell now. I do remember that, you know, things... I felt like a man sticking out like a sore thumb, you know, a young, fit man, and Everyone else had gone and I hadn't. All I can say is that I rang up Professor Arnold Riley and said, look, this is getting a bit of a farce. I want to join up. He said, oh, that's all right. You carry on. So I did. And I know that he volunteered straight away for the Fleet Air Arm. But at that time, of course, they had so many recruits that the waiting list for flying crew was a long, long, long one. And as a result of volunteering, I wasn't called up until long, long after my age group had been conscripted. Do you get the idea? If I'd been conscripted, I'd have been called up much, much earlier than if I'd volunteered. But I was kept in the waiting list in civilian life because they had such a backlog of people to be trained in flying duties.
What happened then?
Well, I joined up in April or March or April 41, and I went, reported to HMS Daedalus at Leon Solent, which was the initial training wing where we were kitted out and learnt to squad drill, marching, and all that sort of thing. Then we went across to Gosport, HMS St Vincent, which again was initial training into the Navy to do it how Nelson did it, learning all the traditions of the Navy, of which, of course, I knew a lot, being the son of a naval man himself. We learnt navigation, semaphore, Morse signalling, bayonet fighting, which struck us as rather peculiar. We didn't reckon that we'd ever become bayonet fighters, but there we are, we were taught bayonet fighting. We used to go down to Portsmouth Harbour and pull whalers around the sea there to initiate us, I suppose, into saltwater routine. A little bit useless, really, considering the fact that we're going to be flying men. After we'd finished at Gosport, and there was a little bit of a fallout rate there, some people didn't pass it, of course, we went on to number one elementary flying training school at Elmden in Birmingham, and there we learnt how to fly on Tiger Moths. I remember I took, I think it was about 9 or 10 hours dual instruction before I flew solo, and we spent a couple of months up there in the summer of 41 flying all the hours that God gave us, because it was a beautiful summer, and normally one did ground instruction half a day and flying half a day. But with the double British summertime and the good weather, we used to fly again after supper up until 10 o'clock at night sometimes. So we were quite intensively trained. And I suppose it was about 3 months at Elmden, which you can see from my list there. And then we were asked to volunteer for where we wanted to be trained on our service training. And there were two choices. One was to go to Canada, and one was to go to RAF Netheravon on Salisbury Plain. I volunteered for Canada and was sent to Netheravon. All the married men, which weren't very many, volunteered from Netheravon, obviously, and got sent to Canada. So there wasn't really much object in volunteering anyway. It was typical of things as they were in those days. However, we went to Netheravon, which is called an aerodrome, but it was obviously one that the RAF didn't want, because it was on two sites. Depending on the direction of the wind, you could take off on the top aerodrome, circle, and land on the bottom aerodrome. And if the wind was across, one took off on the top, did a left-hand circuit, and landed on the left-hand aerodrome, or took off on the right-hand aerodrome, did a right-hand circuit, and landed on the bottom, so we didn't collide. It was absolutely ridiculous as an aerodrome. So much so that one couldn't night fly there. When one wanted to night fly, we had to go to a little place called Shrewton, Shrewton, which is, I don't know, I pass it on the road whenever I'm going up the A303 now, which amounted to a bit of grass beside a turnip field. And the only lights we had at those times were what were called gooseneck flares, which were laid out according to the direction of the wind, and we flew from there. I've only got two recollections of night flying there. One is that we were flying battles, incidentally, at this time, and these were the battles which had been used in the Battle of France and had been used for, I think some of them had been used for, the ones that got back, for bombing those bridges. If you remember, there was a quite a brave attack on some bridges, which was completely futile. And one of the instructors had been in this Battle of France, and he was quite a gung-ho individual. And he took a pupil up at night in a battle, which wasn't supposed to be aerobatic anyway, and did a slow roll at night, pitch black, over the flare path. you know, absolutely ridiculous, but got away with it. The other thing I remember at that time was the one time in the instruments, and I couldn't. This is a common phenomenon when you're night flying, that you don't believe your instruments are telling the right thing. I looked out over the cockpit, and I found the stars were down there. And was looking down on the stars, and I suddenly realised, you know, that I was upside down. And I thought, well, what have I got to do? Believe my instruments. And it took quite a lot of willpower for me to believe that my instruments were right, but, you know, it was the one thing the same. That is my recollection of night flying at Netherhaven. And the other thing is, of course, going over to Shrewton in a coach with all the gang and singing songs on the way there. I don't remember what the songs were, but they were the songs that were in vogue at that time. So halfway through Netherhaven, we were awarded our wings, and then we went on and did dive bombing practice. We went to RAF Porthcawl for live air firing practice. It was generally cross countries, reconnaissance flights, that sort of thing. At the end of service flying training school at Netherhaven, which was about November, December, we then went to, we were given our commissions then, as acting sub-lieutenants or midshipmen if you're under 20. And we were piled off to RN College, Greenwich, to become gentlemen. What we used to call the knife and fork course. We were taught how to, what knives and forks to use and which way the port went and all this sort of thing. My one recollection of Greenwich is that on the first formal dinner we had there, I was at the end of the table and the port was put in front of me, and I took the stopper out and started helping myself, at which a wren rushed up to say, no, you take the stopper out and pass it, and when it comes round to you, then you take yours and put the stopper back in. But the most outstanding memory of Royal Naval College, Greenwich, was that each night one of us had to be the duty boy, duty officer, in which case you were in charge of the firewatch duties and you had to make rounds every now and again. And I happened to be, purely by chance, the duty officer, or duty sub-lieutenant, whatever you like to call it, on a particular day when they were having a very ceremonial dinner at which all the bigwigs of the college attended. There was a commodore in charge of the college at that time, and he was a racing driver by the name of Commodore, can't remember, I'll come back to that if I can remember. But one of the duties of the duty sub-lieutenant was to dine at the top table with all the top brass, and there was some top brass there, admirals, commodores, four ring captains, and then there was a big gap until they came down to me as an acting sub-lieutenant. I remember the name of the commodore, Commodore Earl Howe. Probably doesn't mean anything to you, but he was a famous racing driver before the war. Now, I got stuck on this top table, and, you know, if inferiority complex came out anywhere, it came out then, because I felt lost in a wave of gold brain. I thought, God, what do I do now? But I was very lucky. I was placed beside Lady Howe, wife of the Commodore. And this dear lady could see that I was completely out of my water, as you can imagine. Little country bumpkin from Exeter. Don't remember whether I'd ever been to London before, let alone sat at the top table at the Royal Naval College, Greenwich. And this dear lady kept me in conversation the whole of the dinner, and I thought afterwards, well, you know, there's the definition of a true lady, because some of that type could have been quite hoity-toity and thought, just ignored me in view of the fact that I was a snivelling little sub-lieutenant, and I had a great respect for that lady. However, having completed, we had talks on psychology and giving orders and how to be an officer and a gentleman, and you didn't carry brown paper parcels in the street and you didn't smoke in the street, and lots of other things that one didn't do if one was an officer. From there we went on to Crail, which is the torpedo dropping school, and at Crail we learnt how to drop a torpedo. Oh, incidentally, if I can go back to Netheravon, at Netheravon we had our first casualty, a chap by the name of Don Stewart. He was doing dive bombing, and we were doing dive bombing practice there, and he didn't pull out and went straight into the ground, and that happened on my 21st birthday, which put a blight on the celebrations that I was hoping to have that day. However, coming back to Crail again, this was our second casualty. When Bobby Campbell, he was doing a torpedo attack, and possibly you don't know, in a torpedo attack you dive almost vertically, then turn in and drop your torpedo. Well, he dived, and it was a flat, calm sea, very difficult in a flat, calm sea to judge the distance of the water, and he went straight in as well. However, we went on and did our torpedo dropping there. I think I got it above average for torpedo dropping. And we successfully passed out there, and then we went on to Arbroath, which was the deck landing school. And by this time, of course, we were right in midwinter. It was cold, snowy, and I remember very, very vividly the northern lights that we saw up there. We did our deck landing, or at least I did, successfully. I don't think there was anybody dipped at that time, and I came out again with an above average. And we were sent home on leave to await instructions. Now, in those days, you know, I was 20, 21, 21, 22 perhaps, keen as mustard to get at the Hun. You know, you can't imagine the feeling in wartime that there is to get at the enemy, especially when you're young. And I was sent home on indefinite leave to await appointment. And after 3 days, I had the damn cheek to send a telegram to the Admiralty saying, still awaiting appointment. What they thought in the Admiralty, God alone knows. But by return came a telegram saying, report to 825 Squadron, Leon Solon. And I thought, well, Sally, that'll teach you to keep your mouth shut. Because I knew that 825 Squadron was the squadron which had been wiped out in the attack on the Scharnhorst, and I was one of the replacements. However, I went there, and in the squadron was the one chap who had survived that attack on the Scharnhorst without injury, and that was Eddie Lee, DSO, sub-lieutenant DSO. However, after about a fortnight, the Admiralty had changed their minds about swordfish squadrons, because at that time, the idea of escort carriers to escort convoys was coming about. And obviously, you couldn't have a full squadron of swordfish on one of those small ships. So they were reducing the size of squadrons to fit into the escort carriers. And consequently, as I was one of the last in on 825, I was one of the first out, but I just moved across the road to 835 Squadron, which had just come back from Jamaica or Trinidad somewhere.
Did Lee say anything to you about the channel breakout?
For certain he did. For certain he did.
Did his morale seem to be shaken?
No, not at all. No, completely a natural bloke. Funnily enough, you'll see from my record there that after the war, I went out to Exeter Airport to renew my flying in the RNVR, and one of the instructors there was Eddie Lee's brother. But no, he was a perfectly normal individual. Didn't seem to have affected him whatsoever.
Have you kept in contact with him?
No. Well, I only knew him. I was only in the squadron for about a fortnight, you see. I flew with him once or twice, that's all.
Sorry, I interrupted you with you going to 835.
Yes, we then joined 835, Squadron Commander John Lang, and we had six or nine aircraft. I've forgotten what it was at that time. May have been nine, I'm not sure. But from there on, we were, I think I've been quite crude there, we were messed about a bit, simply because the escort carriers weren't being produced in sufficient quantity to take on the squadrons. And we were moved from pillar to post, as you'll see from my logbook there. That logbook there, I'll show you in a minute, from one airfield to another, and then we went on board HMS Activity eventually. And I remember the Captain Willoughby, the only captain, incidentally, who's knocked down a lamppost with his ship when he was coming alongside somewhere. I've forgotten where, Belfast, I think it was. He came along a bit tight in the overhang, hit a lamppost down. So he was rather proud of that accomplishment. Not many ship's captains had knocked a lamppost over. However, that's by the by. And he said, "Now you come to me as my squadron." And within a fortnight, we were off the ship again. They decided that Activity was going to be used for deck landing training. And off we went. Now, I'd like to refresh my memory if I can. Can you stop it just a sec? And from Activity went to Macrahanish, which was, I won't give you the naval expression because it's rather rude, but it was the arsehole of all places. It was on the Mullah Kintyre, and in midwinter, you know, you could have thought of many, many other places which were better than Macrahanish. However, we started drinking a lot there, which I wonder if I'm going back too far now. When I joined, yes, I think I'd better mention this, when I joined 835 Squadron originally, which was at Leon Solent, I was crewed up with a chap called Jackie Teasdale, dead now, unfortunately. He died after our second reunion. And Jackie was a civil servant, and ended up as HM auditor for Essex and God knows what. He was quite a whiz kid on maths and things. Now, Jackie was my observer. And I remember being introduced to him in the wardroom at Leon Solent as, "This is going to be your pilot, Jackie, and this is your observer." I said, "Hello." He said, "Have a drink." I said, "Well, I'll have an orangeade." "Orangeade?" I said, "Yes, I don't drink." "My God," he said. I said, "Have a cigarette." I said, "I don't smoke." "You don't smoke? I'm a bit worried about having you as a pilot," he said. I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, all you baggers who don't smoke and don't drink," he said, "you have nervous breakdowns, you get all panicky in the air. You must have something to fortify you. And I think you'd better change right away, because if you're my pilot and you panic in the air and crash, I shall have to go down with you. So come on, you'd better start." Now, that I blame all my subsequent drinking and smoking to Jackie Teasdale because of that thing. I don't smoke any longer, but I do have the odd nifter. But dear Jackie, he was an excellent navigator. In fact, the CO of the squadron said to me, he said, "Look, Jackie is so good a mathematician and navigator that the only mistake he's ever going to make is going to be a colossal one. It won't be a little one. So I remember the CO saying, he said, for God's sake, you know, when you're flying, make sure you've got the sun on the right side when you're flying a course, and you know which way you have a rough idea of which way you're going. And funny enough, even now when I'm out in my car, I'm always looking at the sun to see, oh, well, I'm going south. Yes, I'm going in the right direction. It's one of those things that stuck with me. However, just a little aside, that was. So where do we go from HMS Activity to Macrahanish to RAF Kirkeston, Northern Ireland? Do you want incidents off the aerodrome? Well, at RAF Kirkeston, we were the satellite aerodrome of RAF Ballykelly. And we weren't very popular at Ballykelly because all these good-looking naval officers, 16 of us in the squadron at that time, took first choice of all their WAFs on the RAF Ballykelly, and we weren't at all popular. However, we got on very well with the WAF. And at one stage, this was over Christmas, the WAFs were doing a pantomime at Ballykelly, and very successful it was as well. And they offered to bring it across to Kirkeston to do a special showing for us, and the troops, of course. Well, we said, fine, come to the wardroom first, or the mess as it was then, because it was an RAF mess, which we were the only squadron in Kirkeston. We had one squadron leader in charge of the camp, and the rest of it was our squadron. And we took them into the mess, and we rather had a lot to drink, all the lot of us. Consequently, the pantomime was a little bit of a shambles. I don't know if you remember that the Russian dance sort of thing, where the dancers get down on their haunches and kick their legs out.
Hopak, it's called.
Oh, is it? Well, good. This was part of the pantomime. And these dear girls, they'd had so much to drink, you've never seen such a fiasco in all your life. They were kicking out and falling over and asking for prompts. And oh, it was the most hilarious pantomime I've ever seen. But unfortunately, in the middle of it, the group captain from Ballykelly came over to see how things were going. He was rather disgusted with the whole thing. And in fact, sent a signal to the Admiralty next day, get this bloody squadron off my territory, pronto. So that was another move that we had to make back to Macrahanish. Now, my next move was on to an escort carrier which came from America called HMS Battler. And very pleasant it was too, because it was still rationed with all sorts of American food and drinks and whatnot. Whilst we were in Battler, we did one convoy escort down to Gibraltar. And when I say down to, I expect you know that one didn't in those days go straight down to Gibraltar. One went about three quarters of the way across the Atlantic to start with. Then one turned south, and then one turned east to get across to Gibraltar to avoid all the U-boats in the middle of the Atlantic. Quite uneventful, except I think I saw on that trip, Dave Newbury, who was my observer by this time, was we saw a whale, which we thought was a submarine, and we were all busy thinking of sewing on our DSCs, and it turned out to be a whale instead of a U-boat.
Did the whale survive?
Oh, we didn't attack it. When we got down, it was poking water up, squirting water up in the air. So that was Battler. Then we went